Welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. That cut opening tonight's show was Veil of Inanna by Abigail Spinner McBride, a wonderful musician out of Las Vegas. Well, tonight's show might easily be titled Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Sacred Sex and Drugs and Use and Sacred Ritual. First up tonight is Dr. Tom Roberts, author of The Psychedelic Future of the Mind, Enhancing Cognition, Boosting Intelligence, and Raising Values, who proposes bold new research directions and methodologies that advance what psychedelic research can become and how it can enhance our lives. We'll also be discussing his older book, Spiritual Growth and Ethnogens, Psychoactive Sacramentals in Human Transformation, and I'll be asking him about the use of hallucinogens and sacred ritual. Then crossing the threshold into the second half of the show, Carolyn Muir, author of Tantra Goddess, chats with us about sexual consciousness and passionate prayer as we delve into how sexual education and Tantra yoga are relevant to the sacred feminine. We'll explore the nature of Shakti, sexual healing and awakening, and the Divine Feminine Institute for Men and Women. But first, I wanted to give you a heads up that we also have a show on Wednesday of this week. I'm making up for being sick last month. On Wednesday, we have with us John Michael Greer, and the show topic is Spiritual Ecology and What Mysteries It Teaches Us and how it's associated with magic. Charlotte Cressy, an animal rights activist, is also with us. She's also an educator who will be on a panel with me at World Fest in May. She's going to be discussing Living as Love, a co-creation of a kind world through an embodied vegan feminist ethic. So make sure you tune in again on Wednesday. And I just wanted to shout out, if you were one of my listeners who sent me a flash chat with information to get in touch with David Chandler last week, he was the physicist that was talking about 9/11, please email me your contact information again, because the chat flash didn't give me time to collect your contact info to put you in touch with David. I know you probably don't listen to every show, so did you hear the latest? I wanted to be sure to thank all the listeners who brought this to my attention. It seems I was named on the blog Thea Poetics, Goddess Musings, as one of the top 13 most influential people in goddess spirituality. I was right there with my mentors, Rhianne Eisler, Merlin Stone, Maria Gimbutas. Here's what they said about me. They said, through her weekly radio show, Voices of the Sacred Feminine, I would venture to say that Tate is one of the most influential and dedicated goddess advocates of the present day. Wow, that is truly gas in my tank. So thanks again, Goddess Musings. And please, listeners, go and take a look at that blog at goddesspriestess.com. And while I'm thinking about blogs, thanks again to my wonderful assistant, Cindy Williams, for helping me put together my brand new blog, only a few weeks old, called Herstory with Karen Tate. You can find it on Blogger. That's a sort of a platform for Google. I hope you'll go there and subscribe. I have the first few posts up now, starting with Defining Herstory for Women's History Month and 20 Sins and Inhumanities Against Women Today. She also set up my Voices of the Sacred Feminine Facebook page for me. So please go there, if you would, and like Voices of the Sacred Feminine Radio on Facebook. I'd love to hear from you. And if you're the first listener to do so tonight and you're in the United States, I'll send you a copy of my book, Walking an Ancient Path, absolutely free. And I can tell if you're the first one to do it because of the time code that says when you posted I liked you tonight, Karen. Please send me a free book. So please stay with me throughout tonight's show. I have special things I want to share with you midway through, before my second guest, things like the bees buzzing around in my bonnet. I'm also going to try to open the chat room for brief comments. I'm sure glad to see that Tony is now right there waiting for me. I'm sorry, Tom is right there waiting for me. Tom Roberts, perfect timing. Hi, I saw you came on the switchboard and disappeared, but now you're back again just in time.
Good.
So listeners, our first guest, Dr. Thomas Roberts, who I gave a brief intro for our chat a moment ago, is here with us on the switchboard. Now, before we actually start our chat, let me tell you a little bit about him first. Dr. Roberts, he's a professor emeritus in the honors program at Northern Illinois University, where he teaches psychedelic mind view. Started in 1981. It's the world's first such course at a university. His major publication in the humanities and social sciences is The Psychedelic Future of the Mind, the one we're talking about tonight. In religion, spiritual growth with, I never can get that word out, entheogens.
Entheogens,
thank you. Psychoactive Sacramentals in Human Transformation. We might delve into that a little bit tonight, too. I know listeners like that sort of stuff. Also, Psychedelic Medicine, New Evidence for Hallucinogenic Substances as Treatments. Treatment Systems, Multi-State Mind, Enlarging Education. He's a founding member of MAPS, M-A-P-S, co-founder of the Council on Spiritual Practices, creator of Rising Researcher Sessions, and originated the celebration of Bicycle Day. He's taught psychedelic studies at Northern Illinois University since 1981, and he has a website there at Northern Illinois University, niu.academia.edu/Thomas Roberts. So thank you, Dr. Roberts, for being on the show. Do you mind if I call you by your first name, Tom?
Oh no, please do. I'm an informal sort of guy.
Okay, great. Okay, Tom. So let's start with this. Psychedelics seem to get a really bad rap in our society. I don't know if that's a silly question, but why do you think that is when obviously so many people have used them to enhance their creativity, to help lower the veil and find God? I mean, I was just listening to a radio show about the Beatles, and, you know, they were talking about when they went to India and they used hallucinogens, they did their best writing, that, you know, they were the most creative. So, you know, is this about society trying to have power over or control the masses?
I think there's a little bit of that. There are a lot of inputs into the reasons that psychedelics have been sort of neglected or suppressed for a long time. Some of it's political. When they first came out, people actually didn't think that drugs had much of an effect on the mind. It's hard for us to think about that now with all the SSRIs and other psychoactive drugs. But when psychedelics first came out, people thought that anything that had caused a problem in somebody's mind was because of something that had happened to that person when they were very young. And then they also, like any powerful thing, they can cause a lot of good things and they can cause a lot of bad things. They have to be used well. I mean, Fire is a great example of that. And a lot of them were misused.
What is a great example of that?
Fire. I mean, you can light a match
fire.
And do a lot of...
Absolutely. Okay, absolutely. F-I-R-E, fire. Okay.
Right.
Yeah, well,
fire.
I mean, you know, you always hear about the bad trip. You know, you always hear about the stoner. You know, you hear about somebody who just sort of, you know, waste their life and, you know, just from one trip to the next trip. But, you know, are those people sort of in the minority, but they sort of get held up as the example of this is what will happen to you, when really maybe they're really in the minority?
Yes, they are in the minority, although anybody can have a bad trip at some time, and some people are sort of set themselves psychologically for bad trips, because the effect of a psychedelic is partly the drug, but it's mostly on the psychological set of the person taking it and on the location, on their setting. So
okay,
these can
well,
change.
We'll talk a little bit about that. I mean, because I have the sense that if, like, for instance, if you're using hallucinogens for a sacred experience and the tone is set and you have maybe the right leader there with you or guiding you through, it can be a very powerful spiritual experience. But if you don't have the right tone, you explain it. Am I on the right track there?
Yes, you are. The problem is that all the good effects and the bad effects are always sometimes under these conditions, not always. And so you can't really say, if you do this, this is bound to happen. If you do this, the other thing will happen. Because there are all these confounding things. And that's one of the reasons they got a bad reputation. I mean, you wouldn't want a medicine whose effects was practically random. And
so it's unreliable then. I mean, you can have the best of intentions. You can be a solid, balanced person. You can set the tone, but you still might have a weird, scary, bad trip.
Yes, all of those things are in your favor, but none of them are really guaranteed. Now, when the research that's being done in medical schools now, like at Johns Hopkins and Bellevue Hospital, they're very careful to screen people, to prepare them, and they actually two monitors sit with them during the session, and then they go through a debriefing afterwards. So the psychedelics that are used now are not taken the way one would take, you know, a normal drug. You know, you go to the Walgreens and get it and go home and take it. But it's as an adjunct to psychotherapy. So the psychotherapy has to be there as well as taking the drug.
So sort of give us give listeners an idea of how you would incorporate a psychedelic hallucinogen, if that's not redundant, with psychotherapy. I mean, is this for healing, or is this to produce, you know, enhance creativity or to have sacred experiences? What are they doing in these experiments? What is the purpose of the, you know, what are they trying to accomplish?
Well, depending on what you're trying to accomplish, you would set up the experience differently. And so that's one of the confusing things about it. It isn't just a matter of taking the drug and being lucky and thinking of something or having a spiritual experience. But the way that it's done is determined by the goal that people are after. So the way that it's done now, for example, at Johns Hopkins, they've been doing experiments with psilocybin. That's the psychoactive ingredient in mushrooms. But they are very careful to screen the people. And basically they get people who are mentally sound and healthy and intelligent to start with. So this is not a normal sample. It's an above normal sample. One of the problems with when the research is reported is that it's often reported as if, well, you know, anybody would have this experience, and that's not accurate. Or if one was going to go after a religious experience, unfortunately, there's very little done in this way right now, because for all the research that's done now, you have to get approval of the Food and Drug Administration and the Drug Enforcement Administration, and then a local research group at the university or at the hospital. So these things are done very carefully and actually very slowly. So that's the way that's done.
Well, but my question is, say, for instance, you're chosen for the program. What is the doctor and patient trying to accomplish? Are they trying to enhance creativity, or does the person have some sort of, you know, maybe emotional issue they want to have healed, or are they trying to see God?
Any of those would be possible. The research is being done now basically was to see if ordinary healthy people could do psychedelics and not be harmed by them if they do them in the right method. And so they aren't really trying to point toward any one of those goals. Now, what's come out of it, though, is that most of the people, let's say at Johns Hopkins, about two-thirds of the people, had very intense experiences of a profound spiritual nature.
Hmm.
And but a lot of that is because they were prepared for that. The music that was played during the session was music that tends to bring on a sense of spirituality and religious feeling. So it's not just a matter of they're taking it and having these experiences, but they're sort of oriented toward those experiences. And also they're taken in a very nice living room-like setting, you know, with an oriental rug and pictures on the wall, and it feels like you're in somebody's home.
Right.
And so that makes the person feel at ease.
Okay.
But that's part of what's done.
So so do they find, is it addictive when they do this, you know?
In fact, there's a study going on right now at Johns Hopkins, and they're recruiting people who are, nicotine addicts, you know, people who are smokers and can't give up. And they're trying to see if they can give these people an intense peak experience and if this will help them give up smoking.
Okay.
Now, the data isn't out on that yet. But the treatment is not a pharmacological treatment, as with most drugs, but it's the mystical experience, or the peak experience, that's the real key to this. And the drug is merely a way of, I shouldn't say merely, is a way of producing the peak experience or the mystical experience.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
So the people who are successful are the people who have mystical experiences.
And do you recall any of the details that people, when they come out of it, I mean, are they saying they see God or, you know, just a sense of, what do they describe their good trip as being like?
Okay, they usually don't have a visual impression of God or Buddha or anybody else. It's an overwhelming intuitive feeling of sacredness. And there's some other characteristics. For example, there's sort of a dropping of your identity so that you feel that you're one with, and it can be music or somebody else or the whole cosmos. And there's often a feeling of having received knowledge that's very important.
Wow.
So that's one of the characteristics. So there are actually nine of these different characteristics. The way I describe them is kind of like minestrone soup with nine different ingredients. You can have an infinite number of recipes for minestrone, and it's the overall taste that counts. And similar, it's the overall feel of the mystical experience that counts. And one time might have a lot of pasta, and the other time a lot of tomato, and with a mystical experience, you may have a lot of sacredness sometimes and a lot of positive mood another time.
And I would imagine it probably depends a lot on the individual, too. I mean, it's probably very personal.
Yes, that's exactly right. Yes.
Okay.
Now, also, most mystical experiences do not occur with drugs. It's important to know that.
Okay.
Most of them happen to people just sort of spontaneously. There's a really good book out called, the name is missing me right at the moment, from a doctor at the University of New Mexico Medical School who had a couple of patients who had, it was called Quantum Change, is the name of the book, who had these experiences, and he tried to find out what was going on. So he put an ad in the article in the paper and interviewed a bunch of people. And these were all spontaneous experiences. None of them were drug experiences.
Hmm.
And probably a great many of your listeners have had these experiences. They're not as rare as it seems, but people are not at ease with them or talking about them, so they tend to remain quite quiet and not tell other people about it because they aren't really an accepted part of our culture yet, and people
exactly.
are afraid they'll think they're crazy or something.
Well, you know, we interviewed Carl Ruck on the show once, you know, who's an expert on, Carl Ruck. And listeners were really interested because we talked about the Eleusinian mysteries. And there was the talk that mushrooms were possibly somehow ingested and We suspect that maybe during the Eleusinian Mysteries somehow people thought they saw Demeter, Persephone, you know, Hades, who knows. And but you were the first one that's actually said, though, that you know, the mystical spiritual experiences are more spontaneous without drugs than with drugs.
Right, and also, I mean, people can get it with contemplative prayer or meditation, any number of different ways. By the way, I just got an email from Carl this morning, and he's using my book in his class this fall. I couldn't be happier about that.
Absolutely. Well, this is a subject we talk about every now and again. David Hillman was another popular guest. He wrote the book, The Chemical Muse. And he talked about how in ancient times drug use was much more popular and commonplace than we know or is actually taught. In fact, he, you know, got in trouble with his thesis committee because they didn't want him to put that in his thesis. But right. The reason I'm bringing that up is because I'm wondering if you think it's – I mean, when did we lose touch with that – as part of the, the thing that we do. I mean, is it our Christian mores or, that maybe, you know, put an end to that, you know, wanting to, you know, maybe control the masses so they don't feel empowered or maybe they don't want us to reach these new heights of consciousness because who knows, you know, maybe they would feel irrelevant or something. I'm just curious what you think about that.
Well, if you think that your church is the bridge to God, then you wouldn't want people to go any other direction. And that's basically what happened, you know, in Western society, from around the year 1000 on, and probably before that too. So that's one of the reasons that some people who maintain these were called witches or warlocks and so forth. So that's certainly part of it. Also, I mean, they are unpredictable. There was ergot poisoning that happened to like masses of people,
The ergot poisoning. Let's mention that a little bit. That's mold on wheat or something, is it? And that's what some scholars are saying now caused the hallucinations. At places like in Salem or in places, especially in Europe, I think, that caused the hallucinations that might have led to the witch burnings or something. Am I remembering that right?
No, you remembered exactly right. There's a historian, Mary Matossian, who's looked up all that data and found that in places where the rye particularly is a host, but other grasses can get it too, grows, that there were more witches sort of burned, but they tended to clump around years that had bad weather in which the ergot would grow more intensely. And she maps the bad ergot years with the times of witch burnings, and there's a real strong overlap of the maps. Yes, that's exactly right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the witch burnings are a whole other subject, you know, but that may be a part of it, you know, what may have caused the hallucinations. I mean, there are people who believe that, you know, this was all about that's a whole other subject. But when did we stop using hallucinogens? You know, can we sort of pinpoint the time in history when it became, you know, I guess, I don't know if the phrase is right, politically incorrect, you know, we just didn't use them anymore in sacred ritual or whatever they were using them for in ancient times?
I don't know enough to pinpoint a time. It's probably something when you get a big change over a culture, it takes decades or even hundreds of years. So I suppose they were just, if they were used a lot in Roman times, and then probably when Christianity started to take over, they were, you know, put off to the side and seen as bad, and that sort of carried on, although there were still subgroups like the witches who were doing them. And there are places like in Scandinavia where the red Amanita muscaria grove that have been used fairly, not a lot, but steadily. Those, they travel, they found all kinds of references to it in Norse and Baltic mythology.
Okay.
So also Now, I have no idea what it was like in, you know, in ancient times or in medieval times, but chances are the shamans who were in charge of these knew that these weren't just for everybody to do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, our view of religion now is, well, if I've got a religion, I want everybody else to share with it.
Mm-hmm.
In those times, my guess is they thought, well, this is only for people who are prepared and initiates.
Right.
So my guess is that's the way it would go. Yeah. And then, of course, around Freud's time, we got the idea that the only good mind-body state was an ordinary, bright consciousness that we have when we're awake and alert. And so all the other things, including dreams and hypnosis and psychoactive states, were shoved down into the unconscious, and the unconscious is sort of that cesspool of our mind.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another problem. There are a lot of things that contribute to this problem, and actually we're coming over them, you know, little by little.
Okay. Somebody is sending me a question to ask you, and then I want to get into some of the things you have in your book. They're asking me to ask you, can bad trips be minimized, or are they a risk? Well, we talked about that a little bit, but you said that at Johns Hopkins they put people in a setting that's comfortable. They have music, you know, maybe spiritually induced, you know, music in the background that might induce sort of a spiritual experience. But are there other steps that they take besides the screening that, you know, can help minimize a bad experience?
Yes. Generally, to remind the person that he or she has taken a drug and it will wear off. Because one of the scary things is the thought, oh, I'm going to be stuck here forever.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in a place that has, let's say, a nice yard, or particularly if it's a sunny day, you can take somebody out into a pleasant place to be, and that always helps. And as you say, supportive, warm, happy music often helps.
Okay.
So all these things, there's nothing that you can guarantee this that says this will do it.
Yeah.
All these things make it more likely that that you can overcome undesirable events.
Okay. Now, in your book, in part one, you compare psychedelic mystic experiences with non-psychedelic ones. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. One of the arguments that is going on, and I don't think it's ever going to be really resolved, is the question of whether naturally occurring mystical experiences are the same as psychedelic mystical experiences. There are very few people who have had both, and the information is mixed on that. And one of the things to do is to look at each of those ingredients in the sort of psychedelic soup and to see that both naturally occurring ones and psychedelic occurring ones sort of have these same ingredients. So that's one of the interesting things that goes on is they are pretty much the same. And there's a Ralph Hood, who's a professor at University of Tennessee, Chattanooga, has developed a survey called the M scale. It stands for mysticism scale. And people can go through and sort of check off what degree they've had various experiences. And he's found that the drug experiences are very similar. So in fact, confusingly similar to the non-drug experiences.
Hmm.
So that's the scale that's used in all these different tests. It's sort of the standard of the field.
Okay.
You might want to interview him sometime, Ralph Hood.
Okay.
University of Tennessee, Chattanooga. He really knows this field inside out, and he's the person that everybody uses his instrument.
Okay. Well, you know, whenever I've had what I have thought was a mystical experience, it's either been when I was food and sleep deprived, or when I've been in a dentist chair after I've been given some sort of, I guess, Novocaine or whatever it is they give you to deaden the pain and relax you. Have you heard that before? Is that a common sort of, you know, do those, you know, these elements sort of lower the veil, so to speak?
They would for some people some of the time. Again, that's one of those things of not always questions.
Yeah.
It's important, Bob, we should make a point, is that the word mystical, the way it's used in the ordinary language and the way we're using it in religion and psychology are different meanings.
I will explain
that. For example, yeah, okay. In ordinary language, mystical might mean something sort of weird or scary or spooky. I call them sort of Halloween-y. Or any weird thing is considered mystical.
Okay.
In the psychology of religion, it's these nine ingredients that have to be there in various amounts for something to be a mystical experience.
Okay.
So somebody might have just some weird experience, for example, telepathy and parapsychological events do not qualify as mystical.
Oh, okay, because I'm thinking spiritual and mystical. I'm sort of equating the two. We have a caller on the line. Do you mind if, are you open to answering a question?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, let's see, because sometimes my listeners are just listening. Hi, listener from the 804 area code. Did you have a question for our guest?
Yes, I just came across your show and... I don't know if it's only related to psychedelics or if, because I've had a lot of spirituality throughout my life and a lot of bizarre synchronicities. I've had UFO, paranormal, and near-death experiences and
Particular show is about how, you know, using psychedelics can or sort of the future of the mind in the sense that it may enhance our minds. Did you have a question for our guest?
Well, I don't use drugs, but through what I term creative utilization of information, I have a self-taught expertise, and I'm actually bringing in a whole new paradigm of bringing spirituality into global economics and combining it with unconditional love, making everything transparent, ethical, legal, moral, and forcing companies and government officials
to be more transparent. Was there a question for our guest?
Yeah, again, if that would be an area that he is interested in or has researched in?
Well, I don't look into the parapsychological phenomena at all. Some people in psychedelics do, but I don't.
Okay.
I'm trying to think what else the topics other topics you mentioned. Dream work I don't consider as mystical. I think all these areas are very interesting and they sort of reinforce each other.
But the synchronicities are the biggest thing for me, and some of them are pretty bizarre. I have one where I actually read a book titled KGB, The Eyes of Russia, by a former high-level CIA operative and spoke with him back in the 80s. It was before the Internet, and then lost track of him over the years. And in 2008, something triggered me to see if he was still alive. I saw he had passed. When I read his obituary, four synchronicities jumped right out at me, which was, to have them for somebody like that was just unbelievable.
Okay. Well,
yeah.
Thank you, caller, for sharing. I'm wondering if, you know, in your book you talk about that sometimes these experiences help us reduce our fear of death. Did you want to maybe address that a little bit?
Yes, this is very interesting. This is based on research done by Dr. Grobe at UCLA Harbor Hospital. And to understand this, is to recognize that one of the fears of death is the fear of sort of letting go of yourself, letting go of your ego, sort of yourself in a sense sort of dissolving. And so the question is, can you give people kind of practice sessions that will make that experience not so frightening, or even frightening to think about it. And so what he and his assistant have done, Alicia Danforth, is to work with patients who have terminal cancer and have prepared them and screened them and then given them a large dose of or a moderate dose of psilocybin in order to try to provoke one of these mystical experiences with them. And they've been able to do that pretty consistently, and they found that the people's fear of death dropped after they had a mystical experience, and it helped the sort of the rest of their life. Instead of thinking, "Oh, I'm going to die in X amount of time," they were able to really enjoy their life as it was, minute to minute, day to day.
Well, you know, it reminds me of the out-of-death experiences that people who have an, you know, have that out-of-body experience,
yes.
And then they usually, well, at least I can't recall anybody ever said it was, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's a good experience, and they come back from that, and that isn't induced by drugs. But they usually always come back saying, well, now I'm not afraid. I know what it's going to be like on the other side.
Yes, this is the result is the same, but it's gotten at a different way.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
Rather than from an out-of-body experience. Yes, that's right.
And so,
having given up the ego once, it's not such a scary thing to look forward to.
Okay. Well, and also too, there's speculation that psychedelics may boost our immune system too.
Okay. Now this is a real. I'm almost tempted to call it fiction. I don't want people to think if they have a problem, they should take a psychedelic and it'll boost the immune system. And the idea behind that is that we know when our lives are going well and our relationships are working well and the job is going well, that, you know, we're happier, and because we're happier, we're healthier. And during times of stress, we're more likely to get colds or anything else. So what happens is that it turns out that the health, physical health is related to feeling happy and psychological health.
I see.
So that's the story. Now, the question then is, can you use psychedelics to produce an intense episode of very positive feeling and psychological health? And if you can do that, will that boost the immune system just like life events will boost it? So
right.
There's an argument of parallel there.
Well, it is.
Okay,
go ahead.
Well, so that's the argument, and the question is, and this is research I really think ought to be done. It's fairly easy to measure the immune system, and with psychedelics it would be fairly easy, with preparation and so forth, to provide a very positive emotional mystical experience. And the question then is, would this boost the immune system? And again, it's probably going to be some of the people some of the time, but not all the people all the time. So
right.
That's the way the answers always come out.
Well, you know, and it makes me think about, you know, there are homeopathics you can take over the counter. I'm thinking like St. John's Wort or something that sort of helps. It's a mood enhancer. And I'm thinking, you know, maybe we will come to a point in society, not anytime soon, I can't imagine, you know, but come to a point in society where you can sort of pop a happy pill, you know, maybe you pop it every day or you pop it every 3 days, and that sort of keeps you in this sort of state of bliss that maybe helps your immune system stay healthier. Is that sort of what we're talking about in a way?
Well, I'm not talking about something that would be done perpetually.
Okay.
Maybe in a very rare couple times in a lifetime.
Ah,
possibly
okay.
More than that.
Okay. Okay.
Because the problem with the quote happiness pills is there are problems with, you know, with the liver and the kidneys and so forth.
Right.
Again, it's important to point out that what we're talking about is people having one or possibly two of these episodes. It isn't something you get a prescription for and take every day.
So you're saying this is something that happens just a few times in your life or a few times a year or?
Well, probably a few times in your life. And again, there isn't enough experience to say how often should it be done. And the answer will probably come down for different amounts of time for different people.
Right. Well, and you also talk about in your book how, you know, you sort of speculate that it's doing stuff like this would sort of maybe even bring on a new religious area because it would be based on direct personal experience rather than, I guess, you know, words in an old book.
Yes, that I think is one of the huge ideas in the book. And I'm wondering whether that is actually happening sort of at a walking pace, because there are a lot of people who are dissatisfied with sort of the official church things.
Mm-hmm.
They're not sad. They talk about religious, but they don't have religious experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that psychedelics can do, and again, it's not for everybody always, is to produce those intense feelings of sacredness.
Right.
And also we see like meditation is increasing, and the spread of Buddhism is in America. The spread of Buddhism is largely due to people who had psychedelics, and said, is there some other way of doing this? What's going on here?
Right.
And so
right.
We see meditation being used increasingly in a number of different churches.
Mm-hmm.
This may be opening up a way of, I see sort of an additional era in religion. Right now we're in a word-oriented era.
Right.
And we talk about text and belief and doctrine, and these are all word things.
Right, right. I understand that. Well, you know, myself, I call myself a recovering Catholic. You know, I grew up in the Bible Belt, and I never had a mystical experience as a Catholic, but I did have a mystical experience when I started studying and reading about the feminine face of God. And it was totally separate from organized religion. And I think once you have one of these experiences, there's sort of no turning back then, you know?
Right.
It's like it just sort of opens your mind to other possibilities, and you can't live in that narrow little box anymore.
That's right. Well, Catholicism, by the way, has a very long and powerful mystical tradition within it. And you don't often won't get it from like a local priest, but, you know, get hold of some people who know that field or start looking it up. For example, St. Thomas Aquinas
mm-hmm.
Had a very powerful mystical experience, and Ignatius Loyola did. And
okay.
If you start looking back, you find and of course there's St. Clair, and there are a whole bunch of
Hildegard von Bingen was another.
Absolutely.
And, and actually the person who recommended you to me, I can't find his name at the moment. I think the gentleman's name is Horowitz. Oh yeah, he actually wrote one of the books, Sisters of the Extreme.
Michael Horowitz.
Horowitz. Yeah, he's actually going to be talking about a Christian mystic who's had experience. He's going to be on the show in a few weeks, and we're going to talking about that.
He's very well informed in the field.
Yeah.
He may know more about the psychedelic books than anybody else, because when I have a question, he's the person I ask.
Okay. So
your listeners will really enjoy him.
So the Christian mysticism is sort of, I guess more or less buried by by organized religion. I guess just like with goddess spirituality, you really got to go dig it out. You know, it's not going to be the thing that they're teaching you about in Sunday school by any stretch of the imagination.
That's right. But also, I mean, all the major religions have a mystical tradition within them.
Mm-hmm.
And the mystics of different religions tend to resemble each other more than they actually resemble the sort of mainline of their church.
Interesting, isn't it?
They've all had these experiences that are either the same or very similar, and there's a lot of argument over whether they can be the same if they're in different religions, and I don't think that's ever going to be resolved.
Well, you know, just as anecdotally, you know, my opinion would be, you know, once you've had a mystical experience and you've sort of touched the divine source, if there's such a thing, then, you know, maybe that's when you really understand the oneness of it all, and you sort of leave aside this my religion's, you know, bigger and better than your religion kind of idea. You know,
I think you're exactly right on that.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, all right.
Tolerant of all religions.
Yeah, I mean, you realize it's not all about this man-made dogma stuff. It's really about something much bigger and overarching, and leave all the books behind and just kind of feel it. You know.
Yeah.
And you see, that's in a way with the feminine face of God is about. It's more about feeling it, and once you feel it, then you know, you're hooked. But anyway,
one other thing here is the question, you know, is who should probably run sessions for spiritual development? The doctors, of course, would do the health area. And I think probably some orders of nuns would be exactly right for this.
Mm-hmm.
The ones I've had in my classes have been very warm, loving, supportive people. And that's the type of person you need to sit with somebody who's going through this type of experience.
Not some sort of clinical scientist. A clinical scientist that's just too, that doesn't produce the right energetic or tone, so to speak.
Yeah. Yes, right.
Okay.
The nuns I've had in my classes, I thought, boy, they would be really, really, well, I suppose some of them are psychotherapists, but the loving, understanding, warmth and love that comes from them is just what you'd want
right.
from a spiritual psychedelic experience.
So then the second part of your book, you know, sort of, I guess, maybe leaving the mystical aside for a moment. So your book also talks about using psychedelics for raising intelligence and enhanced cognition. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah. Let me talk about the big idea that's behind it. And that's that basically we learn to use our mind in what I consider our ordinary default state of consciousness. It's the one most of us are in most of the time. But just as in a computer you can write a large number of programs for different kinds of information processing, we can do the same thing in our minds. And the different mind-body states, whether brought by psychedelics or hypnosis or sleep and so forth, we see as similar to programs in a computer. So just as we can use different computer programs to do different things, we can use different mind-body programs to do different things. And this is where the creative solution of problems comes in. Because when you look at the psychology of creativity, insights often occur when people are like dropping off to sleep or getting into some other mind-body state, which I would call a different information processing system. So there have been some research on this, and there have been some anecdotes that shown that people who have been working on problems, and these are not just people who drop acid and have a great insight about physics, but these are professionals who have been working on problems for a long time. They've been, in fact, often racking their brains on it. The psychedelics allow them sort of to put the information together in a different configuration and come up with solutions.
Interesting. Jim
Fadiman has written a book on this, on psychedelic exploration, and he was one of the people who did the original research, and I recommend his book, and I recommend you interview him if you haven't.
Well, you know, I'm wondering, do folks like you and some of the other people we've mentioned, I mean, I know David Hillman has met a lot of resistance. I don't know about Carl Ruck and Michael Horowitz or some of the other authors you mentioned that would be good resources. Do you find that there's a lot of resistance out there in the world to your work that says these psychedelics can really enhance our lives? I mean, do they sort of just relegate you to a crazy hippie liberal and you just, you know what I'm saying? I mean, I don't even know you are a liberal, you know, if you were a hippie, but you know what I mean, you know, conservatives tend to, you know, think this is all scary shit and we better run the other way, even if it might be the best thing since sliced bread.
Well, clearly some people think that way. Okay, but I don't think most people think that way. And, of course, I'm in a university and people like to, you know, look at ideas and be challenged by ideas. And for something that surprised me, and other people have run across it too, is that when they've wanted to teach about psychedelics and they've been sort of very wary about what their colleagues would think and so forth, there often are sort of hidden allies around who, as they often will say, I was a student in the 60s, so they won't come out and say, well, right, you know that phrase. So,
right.
So they often will say, well, you know, I've heard about this. And so there are people out there, a surprising number of people actually, who are very willing to look at responsible work in this field. And one of the good things that's happening is the research is getting much more responsible. So it isn't a matter of dropping acid and going to a rock concert.
Not that isn't
fun, but the research is really it's very well done. And in the last, you know, 40 years, research skills have improved enormously. And statistics have improved. Everything's improved. So the information that's coming back is much more valid and more reliable than it used to be.
I see. Okay. Well, you know, you said something before, and this might be sort of a parallel track to what we're talking about, and I don't know if this is something you can speak to, but you were talking about, you know, sometimes we get these insights right before we go to sleep, And when you said that, it made me think of something that always seems to happen with me. I will go to sleep around 10, 11, 12 o'clock. I will wake up 3 or 4 hours later with an idea in my head I just can't let go of. I usually have to go write it down or write it on the computer. What is that about? I mean, is it just about REM sleep or something? Is it just about, you know, how our brain cycles when we're asleep? Because, I mean, I haven't taken anything. You know, this is just a normal night.
That's a very normal experience. Many people have it. I mean, I know exactly what you mean. It has to do with my writing. And I'll think of a word or a phrase or a sentence, and I've learned... I think it's really good, and I think this is so good. When I wake up, I am bound to remember this.
You won't, though.
That's right. So I get up now, too, and jot it down, yes. That's a good example of unconscious information processing that's going on. In this case, it's during sleep or during dreaming. And then the parallel sort of thing can go on with psychedelics. So, but each of those are sort of different information processing programs, and sleep is one, and dreaming is one, and psychedelics is one, and so they take this information we know. And an example I mentioned of professionals who've been working in the field and racked their minds, well, they've been thinking about this stuff, and they've packed a lot of information down into the unconscious and haven't been able to access it in the ordinary awake default state, but we could access it in one of these other states.
Right,
That's that idea solving programs that can provide a creative problem solving.
Like my husband always uses, there's something on the computer called Crap Cleaner, or it's a defrag program, and the computer always works better if you get rid of these gaps. So that so everything works more efficiently. It's almost like you're saying the same thing with your mind. Maybe everything's too bunched up, and somehow it just needs sort of a reorganization or something to connect the dots better.
That's an interesting parallel. Hold on a minute. Okay, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, I was afraid I was losing power there.
Okay, we're here.
Good.
So you said you thought that was an interesting parallel.
Yes. Because in both cases, it's being able to tap into those unconscious cognitive processes that are in our unconscious, and that's what I mean by enhancing cognition.
Okay.
It's being able to use a number of different programs. So, for example, every time we add a program into a computer or some other device, we can do other things with that device. And the same thing applies to our minds. When we can access and put in different programs, as different mind-body states, we can do different things with them. And now, a really interesting question that comes out of this is, there's an almost infinite number of computer programs that can be written. Is there a very large number of mind programs that can be written?
Makes you think that maybe there's even more, I mean, it's like,
exactly.
Maybe would even go beyond what a computer can do.
Yes, that's right. And what that means is that there may be possible to have people who actually build and design mind programs, just like we have people who build and design computer programs.
Right.
This opens up a huge horizon of possibilities in the cognitive sciences. Not all of them are going to be useful, of course.
Well, you're reminding me of a movie I saw, I can't even remember when now. I mean, it wasn't that long ago, within the last year, and I forget the name of the actor. He's a popular actor, cute guy. I forgot how he came by these pills, but when he popped these pills, he became brilliant. I mean, he
Limitless.
Went... Yes,
Limitless.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly. That's a fine example, yeah.
Yeah, that was a great movie. we all feel like, don't we want to be the best we could possibly be? And
yes.
That's what we're talking about with this.
Yes, it sure is. Yes. An interesting thing is the way movies have treated psychoactive drugs. Traditionally, they've been sort of the devil's thing. I mean, think of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde,
yeah.
The man with the golden arm, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Newer movies are now treating psychoactive drugs as possibly useful. And Inception is one. Limitless is another one.
Mm-hmm.
And even think of the Na'vi, who were able to communicate by plugging their tails into each other.
Yes, or, an avatar. That was incredible. That was Goddess Church, by the way. That's what I refer to avatar as, Goddess Church. But anyway, that's another that's another subject.
Yeah, right. Or in Matrix,
yeah,
Neo takes a pill.
Yeah.
And so psychoactive pills are not given this sort of terrible reputation that they had, you know, a generation or two ago.
Yeah, where they scared everybody to death, you know.
That's right.
But that's not to say people didn't maybe go jump off a bridge if they were having a bad trip, you know. I mean, bad trips do happen.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I had a girlfriend who told me that, you know, this was a spiritual person who had had spiritual experiences using mushrooms. And she said, Karen, you really have to be afraid because sometimes you also see the demons. You also see the dark side. And, you know, that's kind of freaky, you know, especially if maybe you didn't think before there are demons. So, you know.
Well, that's part of the preparation, is to let people know that all kinds of different things can happen. And whatever happened is okay. Just sort of watch it the way you'd watch a movie.
So when they do these psychedelic experiments at, say, John Hopkins, how long does the, I'm going to call it the trip, how long does it last?
Around 6 to 8 hours.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. So
and,
it's a long time.
And there are two monitors stay with the person all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the reasons psilocybin is used rather than LSD, because LSD tends to be 10 or 12 hours.
And then you can have flashbacks, too. I mean, with the mushrooms, do you have the flashbacks that you did with the LSD? Or?
There's a question as to what flashbacks are, whether they may be unresolved material that came up during the trip.
Ah,
And that's one of the reasons, for instance, if you're doing psychotherapy, you would want to do it with the therapist and be able to work through that material when it came up originally, rather than sort of repressing it. And then at some other time when you're stressed physically or mentally, that have that material emerge.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to start wrapping this up, but before we go, I want to, Tom, mention sort of the third part of the book. I found this really interesting. You write something about in the future may be about new businesses that provide safe, professionally guided psychedelic experiences. I think that would be an incredible business that would make tons of money.
I agree with you wholeheartedly on that. Yes, indeed.
I mean that could open up so many avenues, like you said, the spiritual, the, you know, enhancing our potential, everything. I really love this subject. It just feels ripe with possibility, you know.
Yeah, I hope there's some venture capitalists out there who will read the book and become aware of it. And they could, you know, everything from psychotherapy to, as you say, religion and practical problem solving, yeah.
But, you know, this would really have to be a company with incredible integrity, because you realize I can just imagine the mind manipulation and everything that could potentially happen in the wrong hands. You know, I can't even imagine, especially, you know, the evil corporation, you know, they're out there to make money, you know, like the military-industrial complex always wants to take the science, you know, the research from the scientist and turned it into weapons of war. You know, I don't even know that there would be a way to safeguard this sort of thing. But if it could be done with integrity, with absolute integrity, it would be incredible.
Well, I think it could be if you get the right people running it. And of course, it would be closely associated with the medical community.
Yeah.
The psychiatric community, the mental health community, the religious community, so places that have good integrity.
Right.
And the professionals, of course, that have to be screened and prepared for that particular specialty, just like they are for other specialties.
Right. Well, this has been an awesome conversation, Tom. Thank you so much. And I believe let me just make sure, I think my next guest is on the switchboard here. Carolyn, is that you? Carolyn, is that you?
Yes, yes.
Okay, we're going to get to you in just a minute here. I just wanted to make sure that was you because I didn't have your phone number to recognize you on the switchboard.
Oh, that's fine.
Okay, so we'll be right back to you.
Mm-hmm.
So Tom, before we say goodnight, I know we've talked about a lot of things. Is there anything I haven't asked you that you wanted to make sure you shared with listeners before we go?
Well, I think the main thing is to realize that what we're talking about here is taking psychedelics in very carefully controlled environments.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, not getting a prescription and then going home and taking it in your backyard.
Right.
And being prepared for it.
Right.
So this is a whole process, and psychedelics are just part of a part of the psychotherapeutic process or religious process. And the drug helps the event happen, but you can't say that it actually causes it itself because it's the person's mind and situation that are all, you know, part of the soup.
Right. Well, and let's punctuate, too, what we said at the top of the hour, that more religious experiences have happened without psychedelic drugs, if that's what you're looking for, a spiritual experience, than with drugs.
Yes, that's absolutely right. In my book, I talk about the psychedelic ones, and I should have said more about that this is only, you know, one little group out of all the mystical experiences.
Right. So so before you go tonight, why don't you mention the titles of your books again and where listeners could find the books?
Okay. Well, the one that's just out, we've been talking about mostly, is called The Psychedelic Future of the Mind. And then an earlier book is an anthology of writings called A Spiritual Growth, with Entheogens. And they're available from Barnes & Noble and Amazon, and any bookseller can get them for you. Amazon has a very low price right now, so I'd say that's a good way to go.
Okay.
Anything else?
And
I've tried to make them very readable type of books. These are not heavy academic books.
Okay.
They're for the ordinary reader.
Okay. Well, you know what? Thank you so much for your time tonight. It's really been a fun conversation. We sort of took this down a different path, and I think it was very informative. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed talking with you.
Okay.
Bye.
Good night. Well, listeners, you know what that means. We've crossed the threshold into the second half of the show. And I'd like to start by asking my listeners to do me a favor. My publisher has about 1,000 copies of my book left, the one that's called Sacred Places of Goddess, left in inventory. And I have about 100 copies myself. I would really like to sell out those copies and not to have to continue to pay all the fees my publisher charges me for the unsold books. Once these books are sold, he and I can more quickly part ways and move on. So if you'd like to do me a favor, and if you're looking for a great book for a friend, for a birthday, or some particular occasion, think about my book. Once the books are sold, then I'm going to be able to, move on and do some other things. Or another idea I have is send me a donation of $20 and I'll donate a book to a library or a worthy cause in your name. And thanks for your consideration. If every one of my listeners bought one copy as a gift, this could be done really quick. So I'm just putting it out there. And did you know that International Mother Earth Day is coming on April 22nd? This is not to be confused with Earth Day celebrations. This is a bit different and separate, but equally important. And I discovered this by looking at the United Nations website last week. So you might want to go take a look and find out about Mother Earth Day coming up April 22nd. I also hope you'll listen to the free spring meditation I have there in the archives for you, as well as my talk on the Messiah, She of 10,000 Names. I've gotten some very good feedback, and I love yours too. Also, I'd love to meet you. So if you're in the Southern California area, I will have a booth, and I will be on a panel at an event in the San Fernando Valley called World Fest on May 19th. I will be in the Health Hut, talking about the sacred feminine for a sustainable future. And in June, I will be at the Long Beach Women's Spirit Fair. I also will have a booth there, so I hope you will come and say hello. So I do have some other things to share with you, but I'm going to wait and share the bees buzzing around in my bonnet after my interview with Carolyn Muir, who is patiently waiting on the line here. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Carolyn. She is the founder of the Divine Feminine Institute, and she's going to be speaking on the subject of sexual passion as prayer. And I received her book from a good friend of mine, Amalia Peck of the Goddess Studio in Escondido, and I decided to ask her to share her insight with you, my listeners, tonight. She has an interesting bio. She says that she was schooled in the University of Life, choosing to do her basic training in the Great Mystery. I love that. She majored in romantic love, the healing arts, adventure, and passion. She got high marks for breaking the rules. I love these uppity women. And then she found out how much she didn't know. Then she says, from my origins in a pioneering family, I continue living my life in radical acceptance that that uncharted territory is essential to discovering the joy and aliveness that is my birthright. My foremothers and forefathers left me an inheritance of their wisdom, their gifts continuing to pay dividends in spite of a challenging economy. And she says she knows she's blessed. Again, she birthed and founded the Divine Feminine Institute for Men and Women in 2004 on the premise that education and practical experience are keys to understanding. The book we're talking about tonight that ties into our subject of sexual passion as prayer is Tantra Goddess, a memoir of sexual awakening. It was published, she says, after living enough life to know that I had important ideas to share with others about some of the missing pieces in the expression of human sexuality. She's also co-authored with Charles Muir, I assume that is the husband, Tantra, The Art of Conscious Living. It's a book that still tops the field in its clear understanding of the ancient art form of Tantra yoga. So, Carolyn, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Karen.
Great and thank you here. For your patience. We ran a little bit late there, but we were having so much fun, it was kind of hard to cut it short.
Well, I was enjoying being on the line. It was great. It's a subject that's very dear to my heart. So
yeah.
Fun to,
yeah. Well, and in a way, it's not, I'm thinking, you please correct me because, you know, I'm learning here too with listeners. In a way, what we're going to talk about is sort of, you know, inducing bliss without the drugs. So in a sense, you know, there may be some parallels, I would imagine.
Well, I would say both practices are outside the box.
Yeah, yeah.
Of normal life, and many people are fear outside the box.
Mm-hmm.
Fear going beyond what can be seen and is comfortable for them. And by the way, the first book I did with Charles is The Art of Conscious Loving.
Oh, Conscious Loving? Okay.
Yeah, Tantra yoga is one of the ancient yogas, and it was the practices taught to householders who were going to be married and going to have a life together of raising children and sharing their love, hopefully in a way that was conscious and could bring more enlightenment to the couple.
All right, question. I know you haven't said much yet, but I already have questions. The word householders, can you define householders? And for folks who don't know what Tantra is, I'm going to have to ask you to define that too, okay?
Oh, I'm so glad you did, because it's
okay.
it's got a bad rap.
Yes, it does. You can pull it up on the internet and you see all sorts of scary things. So
you do, all sorts of scary things. And so that's the first thing that often I've had people come to my classes and share in the first few minutes, well, my husband wanted me to come, but I think this is going to be all about, you know, kinky sex.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of the weekend, they are all agog at the fact that this wasn't even about sex as much as it is about love.
Right, right.
So it really is the yoga of love, if
okay.
you will,
okay.
is how I would describe tantric sexual loving, because it teaches the couple how to bring these passions into alignment with their spirituality.
So you're probably talking about breathing techniques, physical positions, energetics, you know, connecting with your partners, energy and that sort of thing.
Those things, exactly. And probably it starts with intention.
Okay.
For the couple to come together, sit together, be together, and create the intention that our love and our passion is an offering to our God.
And may
it shine upon, you know, all of the unhappy couples and all of the families that are struggling. And it's a way of offering a prayer through the passion that you share with another. And, you know, I kind of always liked sex better if it could have a bigger meaning than just what it was.
Yeah, than a wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, you know.
Yeah, well, and I think what got me into this was the fact that I had been sexually, I hate the word wounded, but I grew up in a family where there was some real inappropriate energy towards me from my father.
Right.
And I didn't want to know that, and I didn't want to own that. I just wanted to love my dad.
Right.
And
right.
I wanted him to love me. So it took many years of making a lot of mistakes and jumping into love and passion to try and get something that I was missing.
Yeah. Well, Carolyn, a couple things I want to ask you. First of all, I mean, and thank you for sharing that very heartfelt, you know, intimate thing about your life, because it helps so many people, you know, have the courage to speak it. Because, you know, they say, you know, I think 2 out of 3 women have been penetrated against their will in their lifetime.
Sure.
I mean, you know, domestic violence, you know, sexual assault, this is a huge problem across the globe. And, you know, we have to talk about it, you know, because it affects us the rest of our life. If we're going to, you know, some people never recover from it, and they never, you know, have a healthy, happy sex life after stuff like that, because, you know, they haven't figured out a way to work through the pain and heal themselves.
That's
know?
Right. And without working through the pain, you'll never get to the bliss.
Right, right.
You started this conversation by speaking of the bliss, and I could never reach the bliss because it was unknown to me what kind of pain I was carrying around for many years.
Right.
And
I'm
one woman. I'm, you know, one of the statistics.
There are,
you know, so many women I have sat in classes with who have finally shared their stories.
Well, and, you know, I'm thinking about so many women are sharing these sorts of stories in the Red Tent movement, too, you know, in that.
Exactly. That's a
you
wonderful
know,
place, too.
Yeah. So, listeners, if, you know, go find a Red Tent movement in your neighborhood.
Yep.
And it's worth the drive if you have to drive, you know, because we women need to be able to share these things, you know, vent this, you know, this potential pain, you know, so that we can move on to the good stuff. And the other thing that made me think about, Carolyn, you know, I will admit, I harbor this romantic notion, because, you know, scholars don't know for sure, but I harbor this romantic notion that in ancient times in the goddess temples, you know, maybe of Aphrodite, maybe of other temples, that, you know, there was this sort of sacred healing, that, you know, that men and women could come together, maybe with the temple priestess, and men could learn to be loved, you know, maybe even commune with God, and sort of, you know, not have this, you know, this aggressive, testosterone-driven, I'm searching for the words, you know, that there could be contentment, there can be, you know, harmony, there can be ease instead of aggression. I think that's where I'm going.
And
I don't know, do you have any thoughts on that? I mean, have you given thought to the temple priestesses of, you know, of ancient times? Or
Oh, I so share this passion with you, Karen, because I have felt her in myself. Once my healing was starting to really take a hold in me and I began to own my sexuality and own myself as a woman far beyond my original concept of who I was as a girl and who I was told I was in my family and in my culture, which back in the 1950s was, you know, be a good housewife, have babies, be obedient, serve your husband. I mean, I totally grew up with that. I mean, I'm almost 70 years old, so my early conditioning certainly didn't allow for me to be a woman who was proud and walked with her sexuality with great reverence and respect.
Right? Yeah, you had to learn that. You had to learn that.
Totally had to learn it. Yeah.
I mean,
I had to learn
let's face it, religion does a number on so many of us. You know, it, I mean, I hate to say it, but I'm going to say it because we're uppity women here and we speak the truth. You know, religion just screws up people's head in so many ways. And, you know, we lost the sense of, you know, our connectedness to nature, our connectedness to our pleasure. I mean, you know, women are getting genitally mutilated so they can't enjoy sex so men can control their sexuality. I mean, there is ugly shit out there. And, you know, and it's, we have to shed light on it. And, and religion is a major culprit that puts women in these positions to not be able to reach their fullest potential, their fullest enjoyment of themselves and find their authentic selves and enjoy their sexuality and, you know, even sex with their own husbands or lovers or whoever.
Yeah, well, you can't have a lover if you're being religious.
Well, probably not, because it's just for procreation, right? It's just to make another baby.
You know, there are healthier attitudes coming through the churches today, thank goddess. And the whole concept of goddess and the reverence for goddess, for God in woman, is seeping into our culture.
Mm-hmm.
And thank goddess for women like yourself, who have been speaking of the goddess and writing of the goddess and bringing this information into the mainstream so that women had a choice between God the Father and goddess the Mother,
right,
and goddess the Earth, and things that we sense and feel, but we didn't have permission to actually claim the Earth as a form of the divine.
Right. Well, yeah, and you know, I'm thinking too. I mean, this is for men as well. You know, I mean, because I mean, yes, women have been hurt horribly, but men too. I mean, men have gone without this love. You know, men have gone without this tenderness, and that has hurt them. You know, they are wounded as well, and I just can't imagine that choosing between tenderness and intimacy and affection and bliss. I can't imagine even men would reject that for aggression and power over. I don't know. Maybe I'm crazy, but I think if they felt it, if they really ever had that, they wouldn't want to give it up and go back to the way things were. You know?
They don't. And I can joyfully and happily shine light on the subject in that I have witnessed in my classes now for 25 years, the presence of men who were open to hearing this information and who leapt into the new energy, shall we say. They were so tired of having to be the old paradigm of men.
Mm-hmm.
And they would come around to where the women would be hugging and standing, you know, and sharing intimacies and being authentic. And you'd hear a gorgeous guy say, "Well, I can be a goddess too. Can I be with you girls?" You know, and they're really starting to want more than ever. I have seen man after man after man, and that has healed my stuff about men.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have to tell you, I you know, you don't know me well, but I have a husband like that. I am so lucky. We were married almost 30 years, and my husband would rather be with women than with men because he loves their energy so much more than, you know, the guys out doing the what do you call it, the tailgate party, drinking beers, watching football. Yeah. You know, he would rather be nurtured and loved.
In that
environment with women than in this, you know, the testosterone sort of, you know, the other thing, whatever you want to call it.
Well, you know, I've only been around now for 25 years, men who choose that very thing, who choose to be where it is, nurturing and authentic, and there's a softness and a comfort with the energy of the women so present, and none of them would rather go out to a bar with the guys.
Right. Right, absolutely.
And we
need to bottle this, Carolyn.
Well,
you know,
we have, in a way. I mean, the healing work that I write about in my book, Tantra Goddess, that I entered into during a long marriage with Charles Muir, where our spiritual vows, our wedding vows, included bringing our love to others for healing. Mm. And we knew that our path was sexual awakening and healing. And we were both, I was more afraid of it than he was, but I I faced my fears, and that's why I call myself a pioneer and a successful one, because I really moved through a lot of insecurity and fear to go into these sessions with men and women within our marriage and with the support, loving support of my husband and his guidance and his mentoring as well. And what I observed and experienced in myself was the awakening of this priestess who was so ancient, who knew things she didn't know she knew about how to, so shall we say, slay the dragon of the man and bring out his beauty and his tenderness and his vulnerability. And so the work that I've been teaching to groups at the Divine Feminine Institute and that I do in private sessions is all about, as you said, bottling this energy so that we have a way, we really do have a way, to give to one another in a safe and non-sexual way so we can bring enough spiritual energy to our sexuality that it no longer is something that has to live in the closet or in the gutter or anywhere that isn't, you know, filled with light.
Right, absolutely. All right, well, so let's, I mean, I know what you're talking about, but, you know, a lot of my listeners don't. So let's sort of, you know, we have probably 30 minutes. Let's talk about this. You know, let's sort of break it down. Do we start with telling listeners what Shakti is? Is that a good place to start?
That's a great place to start because we are introducing our listeners to a new vocabulary. And this new vocabulary includes Hindu names of things like Shakti. Shakti being in translated from the Hindu, and please add your definition, but I would say that she is the universal and creative life force that flows through everything all the time in every way.
And you actually feel it in your body. I mean,
well,
she
moves in my body in an undulating kind of way. When I really let go to my oneness with the universe, and I like to call it my oneness with the Yoniverse, because I think there's both. Yoni is another one of those Hindu terms for a woman's vagina. The Yoni translates to mean sacred space.
And you're talking about like that, the sacred pubic triangle down there. The,
yes,
you know, all of that, you know, the wonderful, glorious sense of pleasure.
It's the sense of pleasure from the mound of Venus all the way down to the lotus blossom, as they refer to the anus in the Hindu writings. And it just creates a beauty around the genitals, which we either speak of in medical terms or baby talk or sex talk.
Right.
And
rather
there's
than
no
sacred.
Reverence.
Or,
Yeah,
we've lost that.
So I love the vocabulary and how it impacted me. When I sat in one of my first Tantra classes and heard that in these cultures in the East, the woman's genitals was always called the yoni. The sacred space. And it was the first time in my adult life that I ever felt proud to have one of those down there.
Right.
That I never really had a name for it because none of the names felt accurate.
Right.
And that alone, I mean, that was one of the single most amazing transformative moments for me in learning a language for sexual loving that took it out of everything I'd heard in porn films or read in books. It took it into a place of, oh, my God, oh, my God.
Yeah, because how many women really sometimes, you know, maybe go through their lives and they're totally detached from that part of their body?
Most of them are.
Because, you know, for whatever reason, you know, I mean, you don't think about that unless you're, you know, using the restroom or maybe birthing a baby, and that's about the only thing it's good for, right?
Or having sex, and hopefully he knows what to do so that you'll enjoy it.
Right.
I mean, that is pretty common among women. And, yes, we've had a sexual revolution, and, yes, women have woken up. But, unfortunately, they've woken up by putting the men down.
Mm.
And what I love about the tantric movement that has come into, certainly into America in the last 20, 25 years, is this elevation of the masculine by the feminine.
Mm-hmm.
That we don't want to go here without you guys. We love you, men. And we know that you only learned what you learned, and we're learning it now, and so we'll pass it on to you. And together we will become more conscious in the bedroom.
And, you know, when in the metaphor I think of when I hear you say that is, you know how we see that image of Kali atop Shiva? You know,
yes.
he can't move, he can't do anything until she activates him. And
yeah.
In a sense, I feel like we're sort of talking about that, you know?
We are, and I love that you bring so much a clear picture, so much clear vision of the ancient knowledge, Karen, and what do we see in all those pictures, and what does it mean, and how is it being played out in our modern culture?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, women are not standing over the man with a knife and her foot on his chest and a necklace of skulls around her neck, but metaphorically, she does try to do that,
mm-hmm.
to slay his ego.
Well, or, you know, we're in such a patriarchal culture. You know, I could see, if we take it out of the realm of you and your beloved, and I can see where Kali, with her skulls and her knife, is standing with her foot on the throat of patriarchy, because patriarchy has done so much to oppress women, you know, the misogyny
yeah.
of patriarchy. But that we're not talking about right now, you know. I mean, I think she has to conquer patriarchy, but the individual
yes.
man is a different story. You know, it's like we have to learn to love each individual man while we do away with patriarchy and replace it with some sort of egalitarian society.
Yeah, it's a big job, isn't it?
Yes, yes, yes. One
it's
man
a
at a
job.
Time, though, because it's like, but it's like, you know, somebody said to me, we were having this conversation, we were talking about the difference between liberals and conservatives, and conservatives are so fear-based. And I said, so how do you ever get them out of this fear? We're talking about the amygdala in the brain, and that causes them
mm-hmm.
to be more fear-based. And she's a psychologist, and I'm asking her, so how do you get them from, you know, how do you stop them from being so afraid and, you know, being afraid to get out of their little box? And she said, you have to love them,
yeah.
you know, and it made so much sense, but man, what a big job.
Yes.
You know, there's so many people out there that need love.
Yes, I've heard a man refer to the enormous unmet needs for love that men are walking, every man is walking around with, and many women as well.
Yeah.
These unmet needs without even being able to voice them.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I was agreeing with you, and it made me think of another guest. I've been so lucky to have such wonderful people like you on the show, Art Noble, who a male psychologist who talked about how little boys are just taken away from their nurturing mother way too soon, you know,
yeah.
and we could help men so much more if we let them be with their mothers longer instead of thrusting them out into the world on the playground where, you know, then society takes hold and sort
yes.
of, you know, turns them into, you know, what they have to be to survive and thrive in society, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the hope that I want to impart in this conversation and to all of your listeners, Karen, is that there is a tremendously important work going on. And it's not just at the Divine Feminine Institute or the Sourced School of Tantra, which are probably two of the top schools where people are coming to get their healing and their education, because what has kept the sexual energy down in the, I'll say the gutter, because it's not always the gutter, but it's just sex, and
mm-hmm.
it's the animal part of our nature, and that's okay. Absolutely nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just like always eating fast food and never graduating to a gourmet feast
right.
of, you know, healthy vegetarian, freshly grown, a
mm-hmm.
grass-fed, you know, all these things that people who want to eat better are learning how to do. People who want to exercise
right.
and take care of their bodies are finally learning that this has got to be a daily part of life.
So So, Carolyn, when somebody comes to the Institute or picks up your book, what you're teaching them is, you know, sexual healing and awakening. But how do we take that from, you know, words to, I mean, what does that look like when you come into a session, or what do you recommend people do in your book? I mean, what can you share on the air now that will give listeners, you know, sort of some visual cues about, you know, what do you actually do in these classes?
Yes. Well, there's some of it described in the book, especially in my book Tantra Goddess, where I describe sessions that Charles and I did with many women and sessions I did with men, which describes, you know, the man lays down and you create a beautiful temple space out of the bed, and I, as the priestess, do something special to myself that makes me look elevated out of my everyday look, like you would if you were leading a ceremony, a priestess ceremony, you know. Mm-hmm. And so you set this intention and you set this energy in motion of healing and awakening. And you do need to bring your hands to the body of the receiver who is lying before you and begin to access the chakras. And if you've had any training in these esoteric centers of the body, it's pretty easy to figure out where these chakras are. And you don't see them, they're just there, and it's like you kind of just believe they're really there. Mm-hmm. I mean, the genitals and the passion center is the second chakra, and it's definitely there. We know it's there when we feel aroused.
Mm-hmm.
The first chakra is in and around the anus, and we definitely know that's there when we have to go to the bathroom in the morning.
Right.
Maybe not the rest of the time, but it's there. It's always there. And we go up the chakra system to the belly and the heart and the throat and the brow center and the crown of the head, and we begin to integrate the energies through breath and sound that's moving through us all the time, but we're very cut off from it because we're so busy thinking and we're breathing shallow and we've got a million places our mind is going besides running energy up and down our chakra system.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody doesn't remind you to do that or teach you how to do it, you're never going to know it.
Right.
And so part of a practitioner's job is to teach the receiver how to make contact with this essential part of themselves. Now, a video just came up on, I haven't put it on my website yet, but I just put it in my emailing, and it is showing, I show with someone fully clothed how to do an AH session, which is an awakening and healing session, AH. And it's the core studies at the Institute that I created the curriculum for about 8 years ago. And the Institute itself is undergoing changes in terms of how we're teaching. But we have many graduates, and they're all out there doing this work with people, and people are wanting to transform.
And they are willing to
lie down on a massage table and have a practitioner who knows what to do, touch them with permission. They can be fully clothed or not. It depends on the comfort zone of the person receiving. How well do you know the practitioner? How well do you know of their experience and their training? Because you wouldn't want to just lie down on a table with someone who says they do these things. You really
so you
want to know they know what
to do. Without a partner is what you're saying, too.
Oh, absolutely. You can definitely do it without a partner. You can do it with a girlfriend. And
okay.
It's not sexual. In fact, women are so comfortable with each other that women, I've led groups for 25 years where women do this work with each other, and they are clearly heterosexual women. But they all agree, oh, my God, we have never been given permission to give our love and our healing energy to a woman's body below her waist.
Mm-hmm.
That's been such a no-no. And then everybody realizes, well, that's a no-no because the patriarchy said, you better never do that or we're going to call you gay or lesbian.
Yeah, yeah.
And then most heterosexual women have a big fear of the gay and lesbian thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so once they realize it doesn't mean that, then they can relax. It's amazing how much tension we carry around, Karen, because we're so afraid that someone might look at us or touch us inappropriately.
Right. Right.
And we've gotten that since we were little kids.
So what is the ultimate goal of one of these sessions? I might be wrong, but, you know, I wouldn't imagine if you're in a group with people, it's to reach orgasm. It must be something different.
Oh, no, not at all. No, the goal orientation of anything sexual is out of the question in the healing practices.
Okay.
Now, with your partner, with your lover, there can be as much arousal and orgasmic energy as you authentically feel. But it needs to come authentically from the receiver and not something the man is making you do.
Okay.
Because then the woman can really own her orgasmic energy.
Mm-hmm.
And, yes, the man can do, I mean, you can discuss this, and he can do things that he knows you love and that you know you love. And with couples who are lovers, really anything goes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's important that each member of a couple learn to step into the role of awakener and healer. And that is very different than the role of lover.
Okay. Okay.
Because the role of lover has an agenda.
Right.
I'm here to give you pleasure. If it's not pleasure, then, oh, my God, I must be doing something wrong.
So how is that different from the role of receiver or, what was it, awakener?
Or being awakened. I think that what you asked me that I would like to answer is, what is the purpose of doing this?
Yeah.
It's not orgasmic?
Yes, yes.
It is to drop fear. And we don't know how much fear we're carrying until we access the body of that fear. And it's cold and it's heavy and it isn't the truth. The truth is women can heal women, men can heal men, women can heal men can heal women. They can run this spiritual energy through them and through their hands to all centers of the body, including the genitals. And it's the genitals that are the great, you know, frontier of fear. Oh, my God, if I did that, it would mean.
So what kind of fear do people carry around that they don't even know they're carrying?
I must be too big. I must be too small. My breasts are too little. My breasts are too big. Men with their penises. It must be too little. It must be, maybe it's too big. So-and-so liked it, so-and-so didn't like it. Will this new one like it this time?
Right.
There
right,
is
right.
Tremendous insecurity in every sexual situation, unless you've been with a sweetheart for 30 years and you really know each other and
yeah,
everything's out on the table. But, oh, my God, there's so many lost people because as soon as they get into the bedroom with someone, they just don't know how to be authentic.
Right, right.
They don't know really what to do other than what they saw happens in a porn film or
mm-hmm.
what they think they should make a sound of. But sometimes the woman just might want to cry or the man doesn't get an erection and he's got feelings about that.
Mm-hmm.
And no one knows how to talk about it.
Right, right, right. It's all taboo stuff.
All taboo. And yet truth is that every penis has wisdom and a mind of his own. And if women could respect that, and dialogue with a man's body, what's really going on with you, and a man could relax and be authentic himself.
And you know, you're making me wonder if carrying around all of this fear and insecurity, that's probably not very healthy. I mean, do you think it affects your immune system?
Well, sweetheart, look at the incidence and the amount of prostate cancer, breast cancer, ovarian cancer, vaginal disease, vaginitis. It goes on and on and on. It's either the heart chakra and heart disease or the genitals that are manifesting dis-ease all the time.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it almost feels like if we could, you know, like you were saying, if we could bottle this, if people could get more love in their lives, it would just sort of almost create a health revolution. That sounds
well,
kind of crazy, but...
We're doing our part right now, Karen, and we can't do it all, but we can do our part.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And I thank you so much for having me on your show. Happy to do it anytime. This is my passion and my life's work, and Yeah, I know that it can be taught and people can learn it, and it will change how they view themselves, their lovers, and their lives. And with that, knowing that, I can't stop.
So to close, Carolyn, how do people find you, or how do they find the Divine Feminine Institute?
We both have websites. CarolineMuir.com is my website, and divine-feminine.com would give you some overview on the mission statement and the message and the work of the graduates of the Divine Feminine Institute. And there will be more graduates and ambassadors, but right now we have 8 years' worth of students who have come through all of our courses and trainings. And the Source School of Tantra, I would mention also as, I think, one of the finest schools teaching the sexual healing work and the yoga of love.
Okay.
And well, as soon as we start to get an education, we become much smarter people.
Absolutely, on so many levels.
So as
we close tonight, Carolyn, I know we've talked a good bit about this, but is there a final thought you'd like to leave listeners with?
Please, please, please be willing to go get an education, even though you know it all about sex. But sex was created by God, and our bodies and our sexual centers were created by God, and maybe God had something more in mind for us than just getting off or getting laid.
Lovely.
I suspect so.
I suspect so too.
Yeah. Lovely indeed.
Thank you, Carolyn. Thank you so much. So, listeners, we've been talking to Carolyn Muir with this lovely, heartfelt conversation, and her book is The Tantra Goddess, a memoir of sexual awakening. Please look her up. I think you've enjoyed this juicy conversation. I'm sure they probably will, Carolyn. And please feel free to come back again if you'd like to chat.
Thank you so much, Karen.
You're welcome.
All right. Good night. Bye, honey. Good night.
Bye-bye. Well, that is my new bees buzzing around in my bonnet. What I wanted to share with you tonight, because listeners from last week actually emailed me and asked me to, you maybe heard me start to talk about an article that former President Jimmy Carter wrote for Women's Press. And I shared some excerpts from it last week, but some of you have said you couldn't find it and you wanted me to read it in its entirety, and I certainly will. But before I do that, I just want to share one thing with you. Have you heard about the Republicans in North Carolina state legislature that have proposed that they want to allow an official state religion in a measure that would declare the state exempt from the Constitution and court rulings? Interesting. I mean, they just don't stop, do they? So last week, the bill was filed by two Republican lawmakers from Rowan County and backed by 9 other Republicans, says that each state is sovereign and courts cannot block a state from making laws respecting an establishment of religion. The legislation was filed in response to a lawsuit to stop county commissioners from opening meetings with Christian prayer. The religion bill comes as some Republican-led states seek to separate themselves from the federal government, primarily on the issues of guns and Obamacare. And so anyway, I was speaking to an attorney about this, and he said this would take states back to pre-Civil War days, where, you know, they would actually have an official state religion in particular states. So imagine, of course we know it would be Christianity, but imagine you're not a Christian, but the legislature in your state has determined that the state religion of your state is Christianity. It's a real slippery slope, and I just wanted to make sure you know what's going on. There's been a lot of stuff, uncomfortable stuff happening in a lot of states that are being controlled by Republicans. I hope you've been paying attention. But anyway, let's go ahead and get to this wonderful article that Jimmy Carter wrote. It's called Losing My Religion for Equality by former President Jimmy Carter. He says, women and girls have been discriminated against for too long in a twisted interpretation of the Word of God. These are his words. I have been a practicing Christian all my life and a deacon and Bible teacher for many years. My faith is a source of strength and comfort to me, as religious beliefs are to hundreds of millions of people around the world. So my decision to sever my ties with the Southern Baptist Convention after 6 decades was painful and difficult. It was, however, an unavoidable decision when the convention's leaders, quoting a few carefully selected Bible verses and claiming that Eve was created second to Adam and was responsible for original sin, ordained that women must be subservient to their husbands and prohibited from serving as deacons, pastors, or chaplains in the military service. This view that women are somehow inferior to men is not restricted to one religion or belief. Women are prevented from playing a full and equal role in many faiths. Nor, tragically, does its influence stop at the halls of the church, mosque, synagogue, or temple. This discrimination, unjustifiably attributed to a higher authority, has provided a reason or excuse for the deprivation of women's equal rights across the world for centuries. At its most repugnant, the belief that women must be subjugated to the wishes of men excuses slavery, violence, forced prostitution, genital mutilation, and national laws that omit rape as a crime. But it also costs many millions of girls and women control over their own bodies and lives, and continues to deny them fair access to education, health, employment, and influence within their own communities. The impact of these religious beliefs touches every aspect of our lives. They help explain why in many countries boys are educated before girls, why girls are told when and whom they must marry, and why many face enormous and unacceptable risks in pregnancy and childbirth because their basic health needs are not met. In some Islamic nations, women are restricted in their movements, punished for permitting the exposure of an arm or ankle, deprived of education, prohibited from driving a car, or competing with men for a job. If a woman is raped, she is most often severely punished as the guilty party of the crime. The same discriminatory thinking lies behind the continuing gender gap in pay and why there are still so few women in office in the West. The root of its prejudice lies deep in our histories, but its impact is felt every day. It's not women and girls alone who suffer. It damages all of us. The evidence shows that investing in women and girls delivers major benefits for society. An educated woman has healthier children. She is more likely to send them to school. She earns more and invests what she earns in her family. It is simply self-defeating for any community to discriminate against half its population. We need to challenge these self-serving and outdated attitudes and practices, as we are seeing in Iran, where women are at the forefront of the battle for democracy and freedom. I understand, however, why many political leaders can be reluctant about stepping into this minefield. Religion and tradition are powerful and sensitive areas to challenge, but my fellow elders and I, who come from many faiths and backgrounds, no longer need to worry about winning votes or avoiding controversy, and we are deeply committed to challenging injustice wherever we see it. The elders are an independent group of eminent global leaders brought together by former South African President Nelson Mandela, who offers their influence and experience to support peace building, help address major causes of human suffering, and promote the shared interests of humanity. We have decided to draw particular attention to the responsibility of religious and traditional leaders in ensuring equality and human rights, and have recently published a statement that declares, quote, "The justification of discrimination against women and girls on grounds of religion or tradition, as if it were prescribed by a higher authority, is unacceptable," unquote. We are calling on all leaders to challenge and change the harmful teachings and practices, no matter how ingrained, which justify discrimination against women. We ask in particular that leaders of all religions have the courage to acknowledge and emphasize the positive messages of dignity and equality that all the major faiths share. The carefully selected verses found in the Holy Scriptures to justify the superiority of men owe more to time and place and the determination of male leaders to hold on to their influence than eternal truths. Similar biblical excerpts could be found to support the approval of slavery and the timid acquiescence to oppressive rulers. I'm also familiar with vivid descriptions in the same scriptures in which women are revered as preeminent leaders. During the years of the early Christian church, women served as deacons, priests, bishops, apostles, teachers, and prophets. It wasn't until the 4th century that dominant Christian leaders, all men, twisted and distorted holy scriptures to perpetuate their ascendant positions within the religious hierarchy. The truth is that male religious leaders have had and still have an option to interpret holy teachings either to exalt or subjugate women. They have, for their own selfish ends, overwhelmingly chosen the latter. Their continuing choice provides the foundations or justification for much of the pervasive persecution and abuse of women throughout the world. This is in clear violation not just of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but also the teachings of Jesus Christ, the Apostle Paul, Moses and the prophets, Muhammad and founders of other great religions, all of whom have called for proper and equitable treatment of all the children of God. It is time we had the courage to challenge these views. That's Jimmy Carter, former President of the United States from 1977 to 1981. His article in the Women's Press, dated January 25th, called Losing My Religion for Equality. Thank you, Jimmy Carter.
Most people see humankind as really separate from nature and separate from the earth. I'm as much of this earth as a rock or a tree is. And I came out of it. This is my mother planet. I grew out of this earth.
As long as we conceive of divinity as above us or outside of us, or that our bodies are somehow less divine than spirit, there's no way that we can change our course.
Blood of her veins, the rivers, voice of her breath, the wind, fire of her will, erupting volcanoes, green of her hair, the rolling grass hills, strength of her spine, mountains, tall backs. Can you visualize it? I know I can. Persephone, moon maiden, whose returning steps grant springtime once more. These are the opening words from Dancing with Gaia. Dancing with Gaia is a wonderful film about the goddess, sacred sexuality, and about connecting to the earth and ways to do just that. It gives you tools to connect in a very real way to the landscape and spirit of the earth around you. It's also visually stunning. The DVD comes packaged with useful booklet. It's only $20 from dancingwithgaia.com. So, thank you, listeners, for tuning in tonight. As we bring tonight's show to a close, I want to remind you of some of our most recent guests. If you haven't had a chance to listen yet, we had Tony Burrows on the show talking about the law of agreement, Earl Lee, psychoactive plants and cults of the dead within ancient contemporary religions, including Christianity. We had Amalia Peck talking about sacred space for the sacred feminine, Judith Nyland, Ireland Spiritual Heritage, Constance Tippett, The Goddess Timeline and 30,000 Years of Goddess Imagery, Normandy Ellis, Ancient Egyptian Magic, Patrick McCollum and Selena Fox, Pagan Religious Freedom and Lady Libertas, the Political Goddess, David Hillman, on why Christianity will never defeat Aphrodite or love. Linda Isles, talking about her new book on Bast, the cat goddess of ancient Egypt. Next week, our guests are John Michael Greer, and the show topic is spiritual ecology and what mysteries it teaches us and how it's associated with magic. Charlotte Cressy, an animal rights activist and educator, will discuss living as love, co-creation of a kind world. I also want to remind you of to please remember the two F's. Please click the follow button on my show page as you get news of who's on the so that you will get news of who's on the show each week without having to rely on getting email reminders from me. And please, I invite you to click on friend and become a friend of the show. Also, please friend me on Facebook, Voices of the Sacred Feminine Radio. Become part of the International Voices of the Sacred Feminine family. Remember, you can catch any show from the archives, and you can listen via iTunes as well. And it's important that I repeat this, lest we never forget. almost our mission statement. Adversaries of the sacred feminine tried to sweep away awareness and knowledge of her for all time. And with that sweeping away, when the great she was made to disappear because of the religion of patriarchy, of selfish and disconnected men and their war gods, women in their power, their leadership, their spiritual authority were thwarted, repressed, became taboo, diminished, disrespected. That's the story. That's why here on the show, I am dedicated to recovering the great she, whether she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and I know you are too. Yes, here we intend to defy, to taste the forbidden fruit, to be powerful and uppity women and men, to throw off the shackles and look under every rock, behind every locked door, and peer into the abyss of the past so that we know why things are the way they are, so that we know our herstory. We want to know how they've come to be so turned on their head and so unnatural, and we're going to go about setting things right. Why? Because if we want to save ourselves and Mother Earth, our beloved Gaia, then we have no other choice. If we want to live in a world of balance, harmony, wholeness, sanity, equity, fairness, partnership, love, peace, it is women and our like-minded brothers, armed with the ideals of the sacred feminine, who will set things back on course. And in the words of author Schopenhauer, the 19th century German philosopher, if you think that this is impossible, here are his words. I take them to heart. All truth passes through three stages. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it is violently opposed. And third, it is accepted for being self-evident. I think we are in the violently opposed stage, if what's going on in the world out there is any indication. And Gandhi's words, he said, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. I think we're in they are fighting you stage, with all the clinics being closed and the rights that they're trying to take away from women. But the next step, we win. So remember, listeners, I invite you, please check out my website. I'm available to come give a talk to your group or teach a weekend workshop. There's also lots of free stuff there on my website, meditations you can download, classes on my YouTube channel, articles, and great resources. I'll learn about my two books. Check out the Goddess Greeting Cards and the Sistra that are available, which are sacred rattles of the Egyptian goddesses. We have those available at the Goddess Store page. Finally, please remember what Mother Nature teaches us. That is, what you nurture and tend to survives and thrives. What you neglect withers on the vine, and that's important to know in every facet of your life, whether it be your health, your work, your passion, your love, your family. And in that vein of thought, I would sure appreciate it if you can send a donation, no matter how small, to help keep Voices of the Sacred Feminine on the air. The show is looking for a like-minded sponsor, and we do commercials, which also helps us stay on the air because we do commercials for a small fee. So good night, my dear listeners, fans, family, friends, colleagues. May Goddess embrace you in her golden wings. And I will say goodbye tonight with the music of, let's see, why don't we use Alea Dejo's beautiful song, Awaken, because that is truly what we all must do, awaken to the ideals of the sacred feminine. Good night, listeners, and remember, I'll be back with you Wednesday. Time.